Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The wait is finally over and sport is back on Now TV.
It's lights out and away we go!
Where you can watch Sky Sports, Premier Sports and BT Sport together and all without a contract.
What a fantastic part.
So whether there's a day, week or whole month of action you just can't miss, you can now stream the lot.
Oh, it's a fabulous goal!
This is your sport on your terms. Search Now TV Sports to find out more. 18 plus content streamed via internet. Full terms apply.
Now is nothing but my way, my loneliness.
What's been happening? We've been reading lots of books.
You've quit reading the papers.
I've given up.
You've replaced them with books.
Well, I've always read books.
I told someone this the other day and they said it was a symptom of madness.
It might be. But I've read four novels in the last week by a guy called Ismail Kadare. We've been to the theatre, haven't we? Went to see Anne Juliet. Oh, my God. Britney and Shakespeare together.
And Backstreet Boys. Everything.
No, anyway,
it was epic.
Britney. Oops, I did it again. I gave you my heart. Oh, you don't even know the words. Anyway, listen, we've got a proper artist on this.
Oh,
week.
I mean, the most mega human being in the world.
No, I think that's pushing it a bit, but he's pretty cool. And I know him really well because of the People's Work Campaign and Labour.
I know him really well because of a TV programme called Succession.
Yeah, you might like watching on that, and so do I. And our guest today is
Brian Cox.
Congratulations on your Golden Globe, first of all. I loved your sunglasses. The glasses you wore.
Oh, the glasses I wore.
They were such a cool look.
Yeah, they were. The problem was that they were supposed to be done for the show, but they did them wrong. They did them as readers.
Oh, I see.
So I couldn't see anything beyond that. So it was kind of weird. But they look good.
They looked so cool. But in your speech afterwards, when you were being interviewed by the press, you said that your whole life you've wanted to just be able to say fuck off all the time, and now you've got that perfect job.
Yeah.
What is the perfect fuck off? You've got a lot of fuck offs in Succession. What is the ultimate fuck off?
The ultimate fuck off? Oh, gosh.
I mean, tonally. Is it fuck off? Is it fuck off?
No, I think it's the weary one. Oh, fuck off.
You see, I think if you did three or four of those in a row, that could go massive as a ringtone.
My dad wants it as his alarm.
Yeah, it is. I don't know why. I seem to have a kind of, my voice seems to fit that, but I think it's actually to do with my Scottish background,
right?
Because I think the Scots really know how to swear.
Yeah,
and they swear, and the Irish swear as well, but the Irish swear kindly, whereas the Scots do not swear kindly.
Go on then, just do the weary one again.
Oh, fuck off.
I can't tell you how much he now says it. He says it all the time.
Well, I always have, but I feel that...
No, but now you've got...
It's legitimised.
I feel you've legitimised it by saying... And when saying it to your kids, you see.
Oh, yeah.
I swear a lot, but I've... Since Succession, I have sworn at you lot a lot. I just feel like anyone
he never swore before, did he?
Fuck off.
He says it all the time. Fuck off.
But it's a great phrase.
It is.
In fact, I've decided it's probably going to be my book. You know, when I do a memoir, I'm going to call it Fuck Off.
you said the difference between the Irish and the Scottish thing. So you're a Catholic.
I'm a Micmac.
Right. And
what does that mean?
My antecedents and my uncle's sedents, all the sedents actually, they were from a place called Largi, which is just outside Inniskillen in Northern Ireland. That was on my father's side. And they came in the 1850s because, A, the blight hit Northern Ireland. And also they needed, in the east coast of Scotland, which was a big weaving community, they had discovered this thing about jute. it's a story, but the interesting thing is jute was this hemp. It's a flax. It's a mm-hmm. you know, that's grown in India, and the Indians used it, but it was always short pieces of sisal. They never could extend it, and by sheer, I don't know what happened, but Dundee was a whaling town, so by dipping this thread in whale oil, they found they could extend it, and they built these huge machines, and they created these sailcloths. And if you ever see a wagon train in a Western, that cover would be made in Dundee, which wow. is quite interesting.
So yeah. how Scottish would you define yourself as?
Well, I'm pretty Scottish, but I am Catholic as well. I mean, I'm not a practicing Catholic or anything, but so I do come from that kind of ritual and sense of the feminine, which is quite strong in Catholicism because of the Virgin. So all of that, you know, is there. I mean, I don't practice it. So that was my background. And then growing up in a very non-sectarian community, which was the East Coast. I mean, the people who came from Northern Ireland were the women. The men were known as kettle boilers. They had no work. They were farmers, and it had all failed. The blight actually started in the Skilling. So they came to Scotland, and with them, and they were the house husbands, but they were useless. I mean, their children ran wild and child poverty. There was the richest people in the world in Dundee, who were the mill owners, and then there was the highest rate of child poverty.
Right.
So it was always, it's always been a contentious thing. And then we had this press called DC Thompson's, which were fairly kind of right-wing in many ways. They even disapproved of Churchill, because Churchill had been the MP between 1908 and 1922. He was the MP for a long time.
What, of Dundee?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and then they got rid of him, and they brought in, because of, it seems a joke now, but they brought in a temperance MP called Scrimmager. And the reason they brought him in was because of the alcoholic rate that developed after the First World War. But because they had all these women who were working and men who were not working, the men, they started these pubs, and the men used to go in with their and get, you know, total
parcel. So that's interesting. So did you grow up with a really strong sense of, like, women being at the head of the household?
Absolutely. Absolutely. My sister is 89, and she was like my mum. Because my dad died when I was 8, and my mum was institutionalized because she had a series of massive nervous breakdowns. But no, the women in my society were in my community were the strong ones. They were the ones.
Just tell me a bit about your mum then. So she, you were 9 when your dad died.
I was 8. Yeah, 8. I was coming up to
be 9. And your mum, you say she had these huge nervous breakdowns.
Yeah.
Are they? If that happened, is your sense that if that had happened to her and she was alive today,
yeah.
would she have ended up in an institution, or was it because of the time that she
Well, it was the time, and it was the advent of electric shock treatment.
She had all that.
And, of course, it destroyed a lot of her memory, and it destroyed her, really. I mean, she went on for another 20 years.
Mm. In an institution?
No. She wasn't in the institution. She was only in the institution for... She was in a hospital for nervous diseases. She wasn't in a hospital for insane. Mm-hmm. You know, she just couldn't cope. And I mean, it was my father had a little shop that was bequeathed to him by his sisters. His elder sister, who was Mary Ann, was 25 years older than him, and she'd lost her husband in the First World War, so she had a little compensation and bought this shop, and to put her brother into it, and she did. Except my dad didn't go in. My mother went into the shop because my dad continued working in the mill as a batcher, which is shoving the big bales of jute around. So he worked there, and then he came into the shop, and he was very good. He was very good with figures, and he was very generous. And his shop was in a working class community, a sort of ghetto really, in a place called Charles Street. And ironically, his name was Charles Chick, and he was like the patriarch of that area. But what he did was he gave people credit, and that was his undoing, because people didn't pay their bills. So he died relatively suddenly. He died within 3 weeks of his diagnosis.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. You know, I was only eight, but I remember it. It was a shock. Because my childhood had been very blissful up until that point. And then when my father died, everything went to hell in the handbasket.
And do you remember your mum being taken ill?
Oh, yeah. Well, I came home one day and my mother was cleaning the oven. And I came in and I came home from school. We had this little scullery, you know. And my mother had had an accident where she knocked a chip pan that went all over her. It was horrible. I remember that. And anyway, well, I came home one day and she was on her knees and the oven door was open. And I said, "Oh, Ma, what are you doing?" She said, "Oh, I'm just cleaning." I said, "Well, there's a strong smell of gas." She said, "Oh, I must have knocked the gas." And she clearly was attempting to do herself. Yeah.
And what was she diagnosed with?
Well, it was just a kind of complete breakdown of her nervous sensibility. You know, she just gone. I mean, it just got. I mean, I think she felt guilty about my dad, because her great thing was, and it's a thing that I still carry with me is, you know, she used to say charity begins at home. You know, just remember that. And my father was the opposite. He was all embracing. He was a beautiful man. I mean, he really was. I mean, he was like, I think. Something like over 300 people came to his funeral because he was very loved. Mm. But it was a strain on my mother, and she was very different. She was an intelligent woman. She wasn't stupid, but she didn't have any education, you know, because she was typical working class. Mm. Went into the mill when she was 14. She was a spinner. Had a drunken Irish father. And he was kind of strange, and still find it hard to find his. He said he was in the Black Watch, and I remember pictures of him, but I can't find anything to do with these records at all. You know, I mean, he was supposed to be. My mother kept saying, "Oh, he's a 21-year serving man," and he was also supposedly in the Boer War. Now, the only thing he could have been is in the militia, but I still can't. I
mean, have you properly gone and had a look?
Well, they tried to find his records in the Black Watch, and they couldn't find anything. So I don't. And I saw this picture. I remember my mum showing. There was a picture in the. We had a press cupboard in the lobby of our house, which was a big old-fashioned coal cupboard, which we never used. And we had everything, you know, bottles of water from Lourdes and everything in this cupboard. And there was this big photograph of this man in a bearskin, and he was a drill sergeant major, red-headed. And, but I don't know, so kind of.
So did you have one older sister or more? What
were you? No, I had three.
You had three older sisters?
Three older sisters.
Wow. So they basically brought you up?
Well,
I
describe it, they looked out for me rather than looked after me. I mean, they really did. I mean, they were young. I mean, my elder sister was a married woman, you know, because they're 16, 17 years older than me. And she had her own kids, and I went to live with her in her two rooms with two toilets on the stairs shared between five families, you know. And I'd sleep with my nephews, who were like my cousin. I mean, they were like my...
You're like your age.
Yeah, they were just a bit younger than me, 8 years younger than me, 7 years, exactly the same distance between me and my brother. And my brother had fucked off too. As soon as my father died, I mean, I think he took it really badly, but couldn't.
What sort
explain.
Of fuck off was that? That was just descriptive. That was a fucked off.
Yeah, descriptive fucked off. And he did. He fucked off and joined the army, which he didn't need to do because he could have been exempt, but he ran away. I mean,
and then did you have much relationship with him after that?
No, not really. I mean, you know, he's like the antithesis. I mean, he was the complete opposite of me. I mean, he like we couldn't be more different. I mean, he thought, "What are you?" You know, he looked at me like I was from Mars most of the time because of my aspiration.
Did you always want to be an actor?
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
From when?
A young age?
Oh, from about two.
No.
Yeah, my dad used to put me on. Well, my dad was a kind of sort of paterfamilias, and so people used to come to our house, particularly at New Year. And at New Year, and my mother would be making steak pie in her dressing gown at 4 o'clock in the morning. And that was the blissful. That was really blissful. My childhood in that way was incredibly blissful. They'd get me up out of bed, and my dad would put me on there was a coal bunker and a recess in our window, and there was curtains. And my sister, May, she was the performer of the family, she would introduce me. And I would do Jolson impersonations. Aged 2.5.
Wow.
You know,
can you still do it?
I haven't done it for a long time, but you know, mommy and how, you know, all that stuff. But
wow.
So I would do that, and my, you know, I get the round of applause, and I thought, oh, and I remember nice. It affected me, and I thought, oh, this is good.
And did you know then that that sense of performing was actually something that, I'm not saying as a 2-year-old you think about a profession, but you sort of knew that.
No, I knew it. There was enormous gratification. And being inclusive, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think one of the things I've suffered from, I've actually thrived on, is being excluded, you know, my life. You know, I've always felt that.
In what sense?
Well, just the fact that I never fitted in, you know. I mean, my education was a complete sham and disaster, and I wasn't interested in anything technical. I mean, I couldn't do. I mean, I can sew, but
we should say for the record that we arrived to find Brian Cox sewing a hole in his jumper.
But I mean, you used to get these little things where you had to make boats, which was the first thing you did in carpentry, you know, because my boats looked
sink.
Oh, man, they were horrible. They were just horrible. They were just, you know, I couldn't champ. And I'd also, with the file, I'd cut my finger, you know, and they'd be covered in blood.
So listen, talking of growing up with all these strong women looking after you, on a scale of 1 to 10, how big a feminist are you?
Well, I think I am probably quite feminist. I don't really think in those terms. I mean, a scale of 1 to 10.
Alistair Campbell.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was your idea.
I don't like that idea.
Okay, well, let's get into it.
You've insisted on.
No, I mean, it's very hard to say on a scale of 1 to. Well, I think I'm maybe a 4+3. No, I just, you know, I suppose the miracle. I mean, this is going to sound odd, but I suppose that the idea of the Virgin Mary was such an extraordinary concept to me as a little boy. And sitting in church, I mean, because we used to go to, you know, before John the 23rd, there was the Tridentine ceremony. There were all the kind of ritual ceremonies that went with it, like going to benediction in the afternoon. So the sense of...
See what you've missed out on, Grace.
Because of you. Parents. You don't do God.
Well, so, yeah, I mean, it's an advantage, but it's... You know, you leave it behind, but it gives you a sense of, you know, what the community want, what the community needs in terms of its well-being.
Did you believe the story?
I believed. Yeah, I probably did. I believed the story in the sense of the kind of effect it had on me. And I remember my sister's weddings, and I remember my sister had to marry, because she married a Protestant, so she had to marry at a side altar, which was quite funny. And so I remember the priests, I remember the nuns. My mother always had nuns around the house. It was, and these big nuns with the big white hats, you know, and it looked like swans, you know. So I remember that, and they used to scare me. Those women used to really scare me. I used to get a little, when this woman came with the white, I used to go in my room and just look tight. But... No, it was kind of formative, you know. It was formative.
But you basically believe in equality between men and women.
Well, I mean, I saw the suffering that my mother had, and I knew there was something wrong. It wasn't quite right. But then I realized that my mother was the tip of an iceberg of working class women who were literally the salt of the earth, who did keep body and soul together. And those women, you know, they'd gone through two wars, you know. Growing up in the 50s, and I think this is a hard thing for people to understand, that democracy was dead. There was no democracy. And there was no fair play. There was nothing across the board. It was just, you know, we went from one war to a depression to another war. So for the first 50 years of the 20th century, we were in total chaos. And it was only when Attlee came along, who I still think is...
See, because you've always been pretty outspoken in terms of politics.
Yeah, I mean, I just came to it because it's just such a fucked up world. I mean, this society is so feudal, and people don't even realise that everybody's in their place, you know, and And I grew up with that, you know, that you can only, you mustn't go that way. You have to, you know, and I've always broke boundaries. That's what I've done, and that's and that's been my life, you know.
And you, but you were labour really most of your life.
I was labour. Yeah.
You still feel your labour.
Oh, I'm labour. Yeah, I'm labour at heart. I just think there's a few wee problems. big problems. Yeah. I mean, but I am labour.
And do you think it's possible to be labour in the Scottish context, to be labour and pro-independence?
Yeah. I mean, we started it. It started in Scotland with Keir Hardie. I mean, the whole Labour movement is you know, I mean, of course, there's old Ernest Bevin and stuff, the work that he did, and those English socialists. But the root of it was there, and so therefore it's something that we created. And of course, we've been shut on ever since. And that's what I feel about my country. I never felt that until... quite recently. I never felt that.
You never
that
felt
at
what, a strong sense of Scottish independence?
No, I didn't. I wasn't really. I mean, you know.
When did it change?
The Scottish National Party was a kind of joke, you know, when I grew up. It was a joke. And it was just. Well, I saw Scotland become Scotland. You see, when I was a kid, Scotland was North Britain. It wasn't Scotland. It had been interrupted. And I realised when I got into it, and at the time of the referendum, when I started looking at the history of my country, I realised how interrupted everything had been, so that nothing was able to ferment or get going, because it's always to the greater good, and that's the great thing about Scots. I mean, they kind of move from a tribalism to a kind of egalitarianism, and it still is quite an egalitarian country, unlike here. Oh, well, not here. I mean, this is London. London was like place for freedom for me when I was a kid. I mean, coming to London in the 60s, come on, you know.
But you know, is there not a bit of an irony going on here that Scottish nationalism, if it is to be successful, is going to depend to a large extent on a revulsion at the English nationalism that has driven all of our politics now?
This is my problem I have. I do not like the word nationalism. I really don't like that word. But I understand how it's come about, particularly in my country. But it's not exclusive. It's inclusive because we're European. That's why we voted 62% for, you know, for remaining. You know, so we have got that. But it's you know, the Irish have been allowed to have their own identity in the South. There's still the confusion, and that confusion will always remain. And because Northern Ireland became a dumping ground for disaffected Protestants, disaffected Catholics. You just threw them all there like a big dumping ground. Scotland is just, in a way, what I love about Scotland and why I feel Scots, more Scots than Irish, but I love my Irish roots, and it took me a while to just realise that my kind of, what's the word? My pliability comes from my Irishness, you know.
You feel British?
I feel British to a certain extent.
But do you feel Scottish and Irish ahead of that?
Probably. I never thought about these things. You know, that wasn't, you know, that wasn't my preoccupation. I was just trying to get on with being an actor. But what I realise is that when you start on a career like the career I've had, and it's been a great career, I have to say. Everything's worked out in the natural time of thing. But I just wanted to, as an actor, you want to embrace everything. You know, you should be capable of playing anything. You should, you know, your imagination should be able to work in any, you should be able to pick up in any strata of society and reflect it. That's the job, you know. Shakespeare says, hold the mirror up to nature. That's your job. And it's a big canvas, you know, so you do that. But at the end of the day, you know, what has been so difficult about this country is it's what I call the feudalism.
It hasn't changed.
People put in their place.
And three times more Etonians have been prime minister than Labour.
Well, exactly. Four directors of the National Theatre were Cambridge graduates. So all our institutions are geared towards that, almost subtly and surreptitiously.
On the independence point, though, do you think there's a case for the SNP changing its name? Because that is, it sounds to me like that's your resistance to them, is the fact that the DNA, the raison d'etre, is
yeah.
if you get rid of the nationalism bit.
Yeah, I would like to see that. I mean, personally speaking, I mean, I'll support them because they're the only people who are dealing with it. Mm. But I just find it. You know, I think we should be called the Scottish Independent Party. It's as simple as that, and that's what we should be. And I think that that's where we need to. I just think
it's interesting you say we.
Scotland.
You mean you don't mean we the SNP. You mean we Scotland.
Yeah, we Scotland should be. We should actually be. You know, and then the party. I mean, if we're talking about the party should be. It should be, you know, because as I say, you know, in the 90s, I went on record as really blasting the party, blasting it. But then I see one's trajectory in life where you know, this thing of getting on and the two ideas of getting on. I mean, Alan Bennett wrote a wonderful play called Getting On, which I was in. So it's about getting on, and it's also about getting on, you know, about the same, the Sioux values and the conflict. And he wrote about it way back in the early 70s, you know, the aspirational thing about people wanting to sort things out politically, but then they cannot throw off their backgrounds. They come with their baggage. And
what was it? What was the final straw with Labour?
You're not going to like this.
Iraq.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure lots of people would agree with that.
I mean, that was it. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I just thought, you know, because I did the voice of Labour, as you know, in 97, and it was one of the greatest moments of my life was standing down there on the South Bank and coming in, and then, well,
yeah,
that just kind of broke my heart, actually, because I just thought, what's happened?
But what about now?
Oh, boy. Now, well, I want to see... I want to see the... Well, I do want to see the party led by a woman. I do not want to see it led by Keir Starmer, who I have a wee problem with.
Go on.
Because?
Well, he's just... There's something bureaucratic about him. There's something... You know, he's a lawyer.
Yeah.
You know.
He's a suit.
So, and he's a suit, you know. So I'm not... I don't buy into him. I was on Question Time once, and he was very secretive and very sort of... And I thought... I mean, it's so funny. I was on Question Time with him and, oh, what's he called? Chris Grayling. Chris
really?
Grayling.
Yeah. And actually, Chris Grayling, who was a sort of probably walking disaster, but actually a rather sweet man and rather open and kind of rather touching. You know, I just thought, oh, this is a nice guy. I didn't feel that about Starmer. I just thought, oh, this is the ambition, the kind of wheeling and dealing. And I just thought...
Prime Minister Long Bailey?
No, I would prefer radical. I would prefer Lisa Nandy.
Yeah, I think I would prefer...
Now that you've lost Jess.
Now that Jess is gone, yeah, I think she's... I think she's calling New Labour Thatcher.
You know, I think she's quite interesting and really...
I like Lisa, but I didn't like her saying that we've had four decades of Thatcherism.
Yeah, but I just think they're all doing that.
Well, we haven't had 4 years. We haven't. That was... Yeah. You know, that's...
And I do think... I mean, I've written this week in the New European about this virus of people feeling... I understand the criticism of Iraq. I get that. But this kind of virus within the party itself that we have to say that the most successful period of Labour Party's history in electoral terms was a disaster. I think that is...
Yeah,
that is
I agree with that.
To me is the tragedy. That's truly a tragedy.
It's
because
a
the aspiration
mentality.
And what happened in 97 was astonishing by any stretch of the imagination. And it was an extraordinary time and a time of endless possibility when the paradigm could finally have shifted. And we've never been able to shift the paradigm. We've never. Right back to the days of Wilson. He couldn't move it. He couldn't shift it at all. So there's always been the stop-go within the Labour movement, you know, when the inability to really follow through in a way that...
Well, you think about the feudalism. I remember when David Cameron was first emerging, and I remember writing a piece saying there's no way Cameron would become Prime Minister because the country has now changed. It will never have another Aldertonian as Prime Minister.
Yeah. But I...
Well, how wrong you were there, Alistair. How wrong you were there. I mean, and that is... I mean, I look at the Johnsons and the treacherous Gove. I mean, I just go... And then Jacob Rees-Mogg, and I think, This is sorry.
That was very Logan Roy.
This is exactly what I wanted to get away from.
Yeah. But don't you think that's happening in the arts too?
Well, of course it is.
It's like the it's there was refracted a sense that all the way through. Less privileged.
I mean, somebody like me. I was listening to the writer, female writer, Kay Miller. I was listening to her on the radio this morning, and she was talking about how she got a grant. I got a grant. I came from Scotland. My mother was a widow. I got a grant. I came to London. I had my fees were paid. I had a living allowance. And it was the best time of my life. And this was in 1960. You know, when there was still, you know, we only just got rid of 5 years, 6 years earlier of rationing. Mm. So we still had this extraordinary thing. And there was that. It was so great, you know, it was such a great feeling. And that social mobility, the free cinema and the advent of people like Albert Finney, Peter O'Toole, Alan Bates, Tom Courtney, you know, really sort of people who shifted it big time. And those directors, you know, like Lindsay Anderson, Carl Rice, you know, Tony Richardson, the Royal Court, what happened there, and that meant a lot. And it meant a lot in one's fermenting of one's political thinking as well.
Do you think this thing can ever be undone while we have the royal family at the top of the tree?
Oh dear.
Go on.
No. It's just. I mean, this whole Harry and Meghan scandal. I mean, it's just disgraceful the way we've treated those kids. Disgraceful, absolutely disgraceful, and unacceptable, and unnecessary, and typical of this fucking press. You know,
their anger and ownership of them.
You know, we're better than that. And this is the thing that I know. Ultimately, in terms of being British, we are better than that. And we've always, but we're not allowed to be better than that because we can't get out of our place, our aligned place. That's your spot. You stay there, and that's the thing. And yeah, that has to go.
Do you watch The Crown?
I do. I'm completely addicted.
It is good.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Mm. And I thought.
But then, how does that sit with you? Because I never liked the royal family, and then I sort of thought The Crown was a good piece of propaganda.
Because they're human beings. You know, and what Peter Morgan has done is, you know, he shows the humanity. You know, I mean, the guy who played Duke of Edinburgh, Tobias Menzies, gives an astonishing performance. Astonishing performance. So I was actually, but just as that's from a creative point of view, from my job, I'm going, wow, this is great material. And it is great material. I remember all that, you know, and I was touched up by Princess Margaret, you know,
Let's talk about Diana. Let's talk about Diana.
Dad's going to now try and compete with you because Diana once stroked his leg.
Oh, really?
Mm.
Lucky boy. Well, she was, you know.
Yeah.
She was not bad.
But listen, how do we get, you talked about that whole sort of Alan Bates and these guys, when you had this real sense of working class people getting into the arts.
And Sillitoe and the writers, right. David and Story.
So it's David Story, The Sport in Life, best novel of sport ever written.
Ever.
How do we get that back?
I don't know, Alistair. I just don't know. I think we've gone so far down the road. And it's all about, it's about our elected leaders just forget their basics. Forget actually what drove them in the first place. You know, what drove you to be a socialist in the first place? And to be a socialist is to be about being socialist, you know, about being, you know, a community of people who think in the same way.
Well, but Corbyn would argue that's exactly what he's done, but he keeps losing.
But you need charisma, you need leadership, you need vision. You don't need plodding kind of backbench sort of reiteration. I mean, his policies are all great, and he's right. I mean, what he says is right. But the guy, you know, he couldn't sell a fucking... You couldn't sell a carpet brush.
No, it's true. It is true.
You know, you come around, you know... I mean, he's got no ability that way. And unfortunately, you know, I'm in part of the theatre. You know, my great cries, one of my great phrases is Zero Mostel in Producers, when he sees the old lady driving the fast car, and he goes, "That's it, baby. When you got it, flaunt it, flaunt it." So I do think there's an element of that.
So if you haven't got it, fuck off.
Fuck off, you know, but flaunt it, you know, flaunt it, you know. And I think that, and in fairness, I think that what Tony did at the beginning of that whole period was he did that, and he did it really well. He was very expert in that. A few other characters I was a little bit more suspicious of, but I remember I had a run-in, not directly with Mr. Mandelstam, because he kept wanting to say nasty things about John Major, and I kept thinking, well, it's a, you know, he's a great man, but he's not a nasty man. You know, let him be. You know, it's over. It's finished. It's done.
But, and listen, the last time I was at this table was to sit with you recording a voiceover for the some of the films for the People's Vote campaign. So how do you feel now that that's kind of all gone to shit and Brexit's happening?
That is terrible. It's truly terrible. I mean, we can't... But it's just...
Brian's got his hands over his face.
No. it's the Little Englander mentality which has come to the fore, you know, as represented by Freak Farage, you know, who... God, man, I mean,
but is that where your shift in terms of Scottish independence came from? Because of people...
There were things earlier than that. I mean, it was a gradual thing that came to... And just because of the way my country's been treated. Time and time again, you know, what happened, you know, I mean, the great... what are they called? The wonderful singers, the Scottish twins, the Proclaimers. You know,
I would want
fundamentals.
Exactly.
But devolution, the Scottish Parliament's given Scotland a.
Oh no! I mean, and also, when we achieve independence, we will do it hopefully without having to fire a shot. Unlike the Irish, who've had to fight for it all the way through, we've done it through that wonderful gradualism. You know, And that's what I'm proud of. I'm proud of that. I'm proud of the fact that we are not, you know, we haven't resorted to, though, still early days.
Mm. Mm.
Do you worry that Nicola Sturgeon, who's obviously very, very impressive, but every leader has their limit and their shelf life, do you worry that there's not a sense of anybody coming up behind that might be able to take this thing over the line?
Well, I don't know enough about the, you know, who's in, you know, but I mean... There's a lot of those people I've learned to admire, actually. Mm. John Swinney, like, mm-hmm. I mean, I just think they're good people. They're really good people, you know, and I understand, I mean, their passion for their country has gone a lot longer than mine. I mean, mine's has always been there, but I haven't been as articulate about it in the past.
Mm.
And I think there will be. I think there will be. I mean, I think...
But you said when, not if.
When what?
Independence. You said when, not if.
Yeah.
When? Yeah. When?
You think it's definitely going
to
happen?
Well, I think we're going to have a try. We've got to.
Yeah.
I mean, and we have to think positively. So we have to think when. Mm. I mean, I think the United Kingdom is broken, and it has been broken for a long time, and we haven't noticed how broken it is.
Because of the feudalism.
Yeah. Because of everybody in their place, and because we do have this, you know, we have this woman who is our queen, who has done an extraordinary job. I mean, just extraordinary. You've got to hand it to her. But when she goes, it should be over.
So let's talk about football.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Scale of 1 to 10, Grace.
I thought we were eliminating the scales.
No. We'll do it. We should keep consistent.
How much of a football fan are you?
I'm more of a football fan than I would admit. You know, match of the day, I will sit and I will be absolutely transported by it. You know, I really am. I mean, it's, and I kind of, because I have a very unhappy relationship with football, because I wasn't very good at it. I mean, I couldn't kick a ball to save myself. I was too artistic. And also I had the humiliation of never being picked. Oh, yeah, I was picked because I was the last man. I suppose we'll have to have Coxey. That was what the great cry was.
Did that have a long-lasting impact on you?
Yeah, because it was. But again, it was. It's been part of my kind of motivation
being
force.
Excluded.
Being excluded.
But when I was growing up, and same for you, a bit older than me, Scottish football was as important, as exciting as English football.
I know.
And that's gone.
I know. It's terrible. Well, it's also money. You know, it's money. It's also that the whole character of football has changed now, because it was all, you know, it was all about local guys and gals. You know, I mean, local guys and gals who were supporters, you know, playing the game. And it's
were
not
you
about,
Dundee or Dundee United?
Well, I have to be very careful about that. I have to be bipartisan on that one. I really appreciated the Jim McLean's United. I thought they were incredible.
Jim McLean at Dundee United. Yeah. Going to Europe, didn't they, Grace?
Yeah.
And I was very impressed and very proud of that. But then I remember the famous team that got to the I think it was the European Cup semi-final, and they were beaten by Real Madrid in Dundee.
Yeah.
And my second cousin played, he was a back, he was a left back, and he was called Bobby Cox. And he actually created a thing called the sliding tackle.
Mm-hmm.
That was what he created.
Well, that's a legacy.
That was a legacy. And he was a great player. And there's a big stand called the Bobby Cox stand.
I think Dundee is one of only 8 European cities that has 2 teams that have got to the semi-final of European Cup.
Really?
Yeah, that's a good start.
Were they playing each other?
No.
How interesting. Wow. Well, you know, and of course, the great thing about Dundee, which is the bizarrest thing, is the two...
next to each other.
Next to each other. You could actually,
what is the difference?
You could go to one stadium and watch the game going on the other one.
Is it a religious, like, no, who it, is sort not. Of encouraged
United,
to support which?
United had tapos, and tapos was a sort of pool thing that they had. So United always had gambling is quite a Catholic thing. It's not Protestant. The Protestants don't gamble, but Catholics... Everybody gambles now. But in those days, it didn't. My brother-in-law was a great... He was, right from the word go, a great United supporter. But it was, you know, and it was... Of course, it was always Celtic Rangers dominated, you know. I mean, it always had been. And then Rangers had their crisis.
But who do you support now?
I'm a lover of Manchester United.
Okay, I knew you were going to say that.
I know, I am a lover of Manchester United.
Why is that?
Well, it's I'm Glory Busby. Hunter. I have
Glory Hunter.
I'm
not
really,
right now.
I'm really
he'll be switching to Liverpool quite soon.
Well, that's on the cards. I love Klopp. I think he's done a fantastic job. I mean, really, I think he's amazing. The best manager in the league. You know, he's such a great guy. He's got such a breadth to him, you know.
Was it? We'll come on to Succession in a minute, but I did love the fact that... Did you insist on... Like, Usain Bolt insists when he does a commercial that the film crew have to come to Jamaica. Did you insist on a scene in Dundee?
No, I didn't. It was a complete surprise. I mean, for the first 9 episodes of the first season, I was born in Quebec. I was.
But was that overtly spoken about?
What happened is that Peter Friedman, who plays Frank, who I keep firing and rehiring and firing and rehiring, he said, and we were doing the wedding scene. It was the 9th episode. We were in the wedding scene. We were in Hereford. And Peter says, you know, I've just done a ADR, which is dubbing session. I said, what? He said, yeah, they've changed your birthplace. And I went, what? Yeah, they've changed your birthplace. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you're not born in Quebec anymore. I said, so where am I born? He said, I don't know. He said, I can't remember. He said, let me look it up. He said, here we are. Somewhere called Dundee, Scotland. And I went, but that's where I'm from. So I went up to Jesse Armstrong and I said, what's going on? And he looked at me, and of course, he's so inscrutably English, Jesse. He's an extraordinary man, such a gifted man. He looked at me and said, we thought it'd be a little surprise.
Aww.
I said, it's a hell of a surprise, because I've been playing this guy from, you know. He said, no, you went to Dundee, you left Dundee when you were very young. And then the next thing I knew is...
You were going?
They had an episode in Dundee.
And how was that? How was that going back? Because it's quite similar, you know.
It was bizarre. I mean, I do go back to Dundee, except now I'm now because of the publicity. Because I had a doctor in Dundee for a long time, wonderful doctor. Because I'm diabetic, so I had a guy who was a specialist, and sadly, he retired. He had to retire early because of his health. Lovely man, Alistair Ramsay Smith, great doctor, and it was a way of keeping in contact with my hometown. And I did it when I was the rector of the university, so I was registered at the university. But I didn't want to lose the doctor, so I just registered at my sister's. And they found out about it, and they said, and now it's because I'm such a public figure now. And that's the one of the disadvantages, because you lose your secrecy. So
but was it a big deal when you went there with a big film crew?
Oh, and yeah, it was great. I mean, and
you advertised the new museum.
And we were filming, and yeah, it was tough though, because we only had it from between 5 o'clock at night and 5 o'clock in the morning. Oh, we had to get out. Yeah, it was tough, but it was interesting. So I remember we went there and talked about his background and the thing in the car. Except I was very angry. Well, not very. I was quite angry because the place they picked is my house. We shot near Glasgow, and the stone was completely wrong. And I just said, "No, this is wrong."
You, when you say you,
is
were
that
angry,
why you didn't want to get out of the car?
You angry, Brian, or you Logan?
No, me and Brian was a little bit pissed off because I
said that to your mum at the time.
Really?
Mm, I did.
No, he didn't.
I did. I said that's not Dundee.
No,
did you?
Yeah, I did.
Wow.
Well, it wasn't. I mean, I was well pissed off about it, and I kept saying, just be careful. Don't go. I mean, there are some red sandstone, but it's mainly all brownstone, I said. And also, there are great places in the ferry. There are all kinds of places that you could go to, but no.
Logan was pissed off that day as well.
Yeah, yeah,
Logan
very
was pissed off.
Off
as well. Yeah, Logan was
you channeled
off.
The anger.
So I was quite happy to fuck off out of it, quite frankly. So that was it. But the funny thing was that, of course, Danny Houston was on the show and become a great pal. He said, you know, this is all very well, but what about Brian Cox's background? What about where you come from? So I had to get one of these minivans, and I took not all the cast, but some of the older members of the cast around where I went to school and where I did all my, where I was, Brown Constable Street, and the flat where I was born is still there. I was born in the DRI, but the flat where I first lived. So that was all there. So I was doing my tour, and it was kind of weird. It was weird. Because I remember when the show started, I said to Adam McKay and Jesse, I said, you know, he could be Scots. And Jesse was absolutely adamant. He said, no, it's got to be American. One way. Adam McKay, on the other hand, thought, that's not a bad idea.
So let's talk about Succession and how that came about, because it really feels like you were meant to play Logan Roy and that they must have just got you. And what was the auditioning process like?
Well, there was just a conversation here. Jesse was in Italy, Adam was in LA, and we had this hour conversation on the phone, and they told me they got the show. And they originally said, well, actually, they didn't say, but I was told it was one season. I was going to die at the end of the first season. So I had this conversation, which all went very well. And it was more or less, they were more or less offering it to me.
How did they describe the character when they explained it to you?
Well, I just said there's this media mogul, not based on anybody in particular, they said it, but he's this one-man band who's, you know, started this empire. And so it was intriguing, you know, it was such a, and I thought, this is a great role. I mean, I realized it was a great role. The potential of the role was enormous. And when I suggested, you know, and they said, no, not Scots. But then in the middle of the interview, I said to them, so it's one season. And there was a huge pause on either side of the Atlantic. And suddenly Jesse said, no, I don't think so. And it wasn't.
So what are you into now?
Three.
When are you starting three?
Hopefully towards the end of April.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how much was the Murdochs sort of discussed in that initial call, for example?
The Murdoch is, well, Jesse had written a script about Murdoch, which he had showed to Frank Rich. Frank Rich is our godfather. Frank Rich, who used to be known as the Butcher of Broadway, because he was the New York Times theatre critic. I mean, the idea of Frank being the Richard Broadbent to me is, I can't understand it because he's the sweetest, nicest man you could meet, you know.
So what's he on?
Well, he's an executive producer. But what happened was, the root of all of this really goes back to In the Thick of It.
Which Jesse wrote on a lot.
Wrote on, Tony Roach wrote on as well, who wrote the famous Born on the Floor episode.
Oh my God, that is just such an epic episode.
he wrote that, Tony wrote. I mean, he and I were both nervous about that because we thought, we've gone a bit too far.
Anyway. No, it was so good.
So anyway, Tony worked on that. And Amanda really, the style that they created is a style that we've sort of inherited. And then Amanda went on to Veep and redid Veep, reconfigured the whole thing, and it was always successful, but became even more successful. So Jesse, I think the story is that Jesse had to do a rewrite of an episode of Veep, but he had to do it very quickly, and he did it in a weekend. Frank, who was always there, and he'd been working, he was employed by HBO, and because he's such a literary man, you know. So Frank read the episode and they did it. And he was very impressed and got to know Jesse. And then Jesse told him that he'd written this, I can't remember if it was a play or a treatment for...
Something about the Murdochs.
About the Murdochs. And then he said he'd like to develop it into some kind of idea. And Frank was his champion. Frank said, you know, this is the coming guy. You know, you've got to give him. You know, I think that's the story.
I saw an interview where you seem to be pushing back at the kind of Murdoch illusions, but you know, media mogul, three kids, two boys and a girl, fighting for the succession.
Yeah, the difference is, and the key difference is, there's nothing inherited. You know.
Logan Roy made it on his own.
Yeah, totally on his own.
Mm.
So he, you know, there was no newspaper to start with, which is what, I mean, quite a lot of these guys come from a sort of inherited position.
Trump,
yeah, and Murdoch,
yeah, for sure,
and Conrad Black, and all of these guys, and I thought it was right that he, you know, I thought it was great that this was a man who, his background was a mystery, and of course. That's his strength, is his mystery, is we don't know. I think I know who he is, and I think, you know, he's a bit of a nihilist, you know, that he's a sort of atheist nihilist, but doesn't give a fuck, really, about anything. And that's why he's sort of embraced what he's embraced. And, of course, but the most important thing is he loves his children.
He does love his children.
Oh, yeah.
Mm.
Oh, yeah.
Why is he so horrible to them?
Because they're such a disappointment.
Is that why you're so horrible to us?
So nice.
I said to my... Because Logan and Logan's relationship with Shiv, right, reminds me of me and my dad just without the money.
No, I mean,
a really strong father-daughter relationship, which you don't see often.
No, and it's very very strong. And it is... You know, it's his daughter.
Mm.
You know,
but what does he want?
I'm the same with my daughter. I've got three sons. I have actually got three sons and a daughter. So,
wow.
So you've got these two families, haven't you?
Yeah, I've got two families, yeah.
What's the age gaps? Big.
Well, my eldest son is about to be 50.
Wow, yeah.
And in August. And my youngest is 15.
Wow.
And, well, anyway, I won't go into all that.
No, yeah. I'm interested in the thing about you say he loves them.
Oh, no, because I asked, I said this to Jesse.
Mm.
I said, does he love his kids? He says, oh, no, he really, really loves his kids. And, of course, that actually is... It's a great motivating force, but, it's an unplayed motivating force.
But is the disappointment in that they didn't start off where he started off?
Well,
they're a bit spoiled to him.
Yeah, and they're entitled. You know, and I actually think the humanist element in the story is the fact that, you know, people get fucked for clear reasons. And this family is fucked for such clear reasons. Because there is a disconnect. And of course, because the father has got such trauma around his roots, there's never been able to ability to settle down to kind of really recorrect that, because he's still not able to deal with it. That's why he comes and he says, fuck it, I'm off, you know. And his sister, we don't know about his sister, there's something about his sister, and it's all mysterious. And they keep it mysterious because they haven't told me. I mean, I don't even speculate on that, because I know if I speculate, they'll go the other way. You know, as soon as I say, oh, it's no, it's that.
Do you not feel you need to know all that stuff to play it?
Well, at first I thought I did. At first I thought I need, you know, because I'm one of the actor prepares kind of fellas. So I thought at first I need to know. But at the end of the day, I get a free song from not knowing, because it's also like life. You don't know. You don't know what's going to happen to you when you step out that door. I don't know what's going to happen after you go. So I actually thought, and I loved Jesse's daring in that way. I love the daring of the writer, not that we don't. I mean, and they know. I mean, they've got an idea. And Jesse's also got a pretty, I think he's probably got a Bible in his head that he's kind of knows. Yeah, there's probably a statute of limitations on the show. No, I don't know what that is. It shifted when they decided that they were going to keep me rather than kill me.
It's quite amazing. There's not a single pleasant character in the whole thing. There's not a single
person. But they're all so endearing.
They're interesting. They're not endearing, I don't think.
I think they are. I think.
So does he have a favourite of the three?
Well, there's four.
Of the four, sorry.
Well, I think he's naturally aligned to Shiv.
How much of a strong sticking to the script is there?
Well, very much so. You know, the script is it, but it's like a sandwich, except we have different bread. We either have ciabatta or we have sourdough. So the improvising bit is always the bread. You know, and it's slightly different, but then it gets honed down to the meat, and that's really the thing. So there's always an element of it. I mean, Kieran Culkin had never, ever, ever improvised in his life before the show. And he's now an expert. And they'll give him, the other thing is, because they're comedy writers, you get alt lines. You know, so they'll suddenly, I mean, Kieran would have, I've told them never to give me, I mean, I've told them, give me alt lines, but never write them down and say, here are your alt lines. Just tell me on the day, the classic one is, what's he going to do? Stick his cock in my potato salad? You know.
Is that an alt line or is that the line?
That was an alt line. That was an alt line that came on the day. He said, what have you, could you add? I said, sure.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun.
Is it fun?
It's tremendous fun. It is true. And we are a family. You know, we really are. We're all devoted to one another. You know, I mean, we have our moments. I mean, there's different techniques involved, and sometimes the technique is a little bit wearing, shall we say, but on the whole what is important is the result, and the result is always
have you been surprised by the scale of the result?
I'm totally surprised.
I mean, it's phenomenal.
I mean, it's just gone off the charts. It's just incredible. And you said earlier on about the role. I mean, I kind of knew that one day. It's so funny about this job, you know. Next year I will be in the theatre for 60 years.
Wow.
Since I was 15. And
I started at two.
I started at two, yeah. And I always knew, people always said it's the long haul. It's the long haul. And I've had a great career. I mean, I can't complain about my career, but I've always moved away from the obvious, I never became a Lovie, you know. I never became an Ian McKellen or any of that bunch, you know. I just moved away, you know. In the 90s, I moved to America because I wanted to do movies, and they didn't do movies here. And I remember meeting Nigel Hawthorne on a plane. He said, how can you do that? How can you play those parts? I mean, you know, you're a leading actor. You did that. I said, Nigel, I'm just an actor. I'll go where the work is. And if the work is good. I said, also, you know, in film, and it was Michael Powell who said this. It's a great phrase. In film, there are no big parts and small parts. There are only long parts and short parts. You're either on a film for a long time, you're on it for a short, but you have to do the business. You know, you got to deliver it. And that's why I loved movies. And, of course, movies was my thing when I was a kid. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a movie actor.
Oh.
When he was left to town.
But then he came back.
Then he came back.
You're an advocate for smoking weed.
I am.
Yeah, I am as well. But my dad is yet to be persuaded on that.
Well, I've lost my position as I was part of this Midland thing about care for addicts, and I'm still concerned about that. But I don't see marijuana or cannabis because of its healing qualities,
yeah.
And it has tremendous healing qualities, and it deals with one of a medical condition, a pre-medical condition I have, which is boredom.
You see, that's why you'd love it.
And I've also got some here.
Yeah, well, Dad, you can try it.
No, thank
Go
you.
On. But I think, you know, in America...
Need any more addictions.
In America, they're really moving in the right direction. I think they will eventually here because of the fact that you can make a lot of money if you're exporting.
Yeah, I mean, and also the great stuff is the quality of the weed.
And the problem is that people, when they buy it illegally, are buying really bad quality stuff.
Oh, horrible skunk.
Can just, yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
You really, that's...
There's no regulation.
And the stuff that you buy, I mean, these shops, there's a thing called MedMen.
Oh, my God. So MedMen, I was just in LA for a bit, and MedMen is the coolest shop. It's like an Apple store, okay? And you go in, and they've got these glass cabinets of different strains of weed. But everyone that works there, they're like, they work in the Apple store. It's amazing.
It's like that. It's exactly... She's
would you go? Would you legalise the whole drugs market, the hard Class A drugs as well? Well, not legalise, decriminalise.
We'll decriminalise. I mean, I think we have to decriminalise. I mean, the problem is, I'm in my hometown, and in a way, I think they were right for me to go because I was probably, but I was joking too. You know, I was being a bit silly in that interview, but I do, you know, I do smoke, but I think that in my hometown we have fifth generation heroin addicts. And that's just not good.
Treating addiction like a crime.
Well,
treating addiction,
but
anyone.
Also not really getting to the roots of it, which is poverty, and you know, and
mental
the fact
health.
That you know, mental health, and the fact that unemployment. You know, I mean, just lack of purpose.
So, should we do the sixth side?
Yes.
You ready?
You ready to do your dream six aside team
yes,
to change the world, Brian Cox?
Mm-hmm. Three men, three women, dead or alive.
So I had a problem with... I can't choose between Maya Angelou and Toni Morrison. So
Michelangelo and Toni Morrison?
No, Maya Angelou.
Oh, Maya Angelou, sorry,
and,
okay.
And Toni Morrison.
Okay.
Why don't you do both?
Well, then you have seven.
Yeah, I can't
you cut.
Okay, well, let's move through them.
So I've kind of gone for Toni Morrison.
Yeah.
Because I was, Maya Angelou, there's the elements of kind of show-off thing about her, which I'm not so sure
that's
about.
She can fuck off.
No. Yeah.
Rosa Luxemburg.
Mm-hmm.
Because she was a Democrat and she was assassinated in 1919 and she was a great believer in humanist Marxism.
Mm-hmm.
So I had enormous respect for her. Indira Gandhi,
mm-hmm.
who I knew and met.
Really?
Where did you meet her?
I was on a tour of India in the early 80s, just actually the same year she was assassinated.
Mm.
And I met her that year. She'd just come out of mourning, and she was astonishing. I mean, astonishing.
Did you spend some time with her?
I spent an evening with her.
Wow.
You know, she came to see me in the play. I was doing Macbeth.
In India,
I was playing at the theatre in Delhi,
wow.
And she'd just come out of mourning, so she was fasting. I remember she was eating these tiny little bananas, and she was just the thing about it was she's so bloody sexy. That was the thing that I didn't realise about Indira Gandhi. She was petite, and much prettier than any of the pictures show in life, and this sort of consideration about stuff. I mean, she was considerable.
What did you talk about?
Well, we talked about a couple of things, actually. But mainly I talked about women in India. And I talked about her. And there was a great revel. I'd been in Bombay And I had been interviewed by this young, kind of ambitious female journalist. She was very forthright and in a sari. She was fully in her garb. She wasn't Western at all in her look. In her thinking, I think slightly different. So, and she insisted on jumping in the car with me, and I was going to a studio to do a film, and she insisted on coming. And I said, "Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm a guest. I'm not sure." She said, and then we were talking, and then she said, she turned around, she said, "You have no idea what it's like to be a woman in India." And I felt like shit. I said, "Well, of course, I have no idea what it's like to be a woman in India." So I relayed this story to Mrs. Gandhi, and she said, "Yeah." And then she did this gesture. She put her finger on the ear and she said,
"Wow."
She said, "Well, I mean, you've no idea what it's like to be a Western woman in India, but to be an Indian woman." And I went, "Wow." You know, you just thought, wow, this woman has got a, you know, she's just quite something, you know. And then she talked about the Jainists, you know, when she had to meet the Jainists, because the Jainists are a nude, you know, they're essentially the nude. So they had to be issued with dish towels to meet her.
And so
she was just very funny and very, very down to earth, very practical and considerable, absolutely considerable. And I thought, and then she was arguably the most powerful woman in the world at that time. I mean, and she did sort of hard things, like she partitioned part of India at one point. She, you know, she for 18 months she was virtually a dictator, but she had to do something to sort certain things in the country out, which she did. And it's tragic that, you know, because she was quite secular really, as a person, but it's tragic that it's gone down this nationalist Hindu route.
So those three, we've never had any of them.
No, and your three men.
Well. The two of them are obvious. Attenborough, and I'm sure people have said him before, just because of his considerable care and his longitude. And
he's trying to save the world.
And he is trying to save the world. Yeah. I mean, there's nobody doing a better job of it. And, of course, Mandela.
Yeah, we've had him, yeah.
But my other person is a man called Viktor Frankl.
I don't know who
that is. No, tell me.
Viktor Frankl wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning.
Right.
And he was a psychiatrist in the camps in Auschwitz.
Oh.
And he made this huge discovery about... He started a thing called logotherapy, which is an excellent brand of psychiatry. And he noticed that the people who died in the camps, he already realized they were already doomed, you know, that they had no way of getting out, and that the people who lived were people who had this amazing kind of sense of not allowing it to affect them in a way. And what logotherapy does is you take a problem and you put it outside of yourself, you know, something that you're swamped by, and then you see it as it is and how stupid it is that it affects you in the way it does. And that's what he developed from this, and it's a wonderful teaching.
It's like a form of meditation, because I actually sometimes do that when I meditate, where you get something that you feel you can't control and you just sort of put it there.
That's right.
Because you can't control it.
And it's a great book. I mean,
I've just read this book by Jack Fairweather about Auschwitz, and it's about this Polish guy, Witold Pilecki is called, who he sort of broke into, he got himself sent to Auschwitz to try to get intelligence to feed back, and he's back to Churchill. He was desperate to let the British know what exactly was happening there. So that's one. That's a big enough story that he's done that.
Yeah.
But as you read the book, it's an incredible book, but as you read it, I keep thinking, why is this guy not being exterminated? And why is he not just falling into the kind of morass that everybody else seems to be in? And he
survived.
He survives and he gets home, and eventually he got killed when he got home. But I shall get that book.
No, I think I actually thought of you because of I watched your interview with Tony Blair, which I really liked that. I thought
the GQ
was,
one.
Yeah, I thought it was very revealing, both of you and of him, mm-hmm. and his inability to. Yeah, he said that moment when he talks about Trump, and you say, "Come on, come on," and he goes, "No, I've got to work with him."
Yeah, well,
you know, it was just actually it was quite interesting. I could see his dilemma in a way that I'd never seen it before, and that was very clear in that interview. And I could also see your dilemma too, you know, dreams and all that stuff, and his clearly his. I don't mean this in a bad way, and it's not pejorative, but there's a sort of stunted thing for him. Somewhere down the line, there was something became stunted for him in terms of his sensibility. Just the fact that he can't engage in a certain way, and I felt huge sympathy for him.
I think you really can see that with him.
Yeah, I felt huge sympathy for him. I thought it was very good to see because, you know, I haven't been particularly happy with him, you know. But I just thought it was his humanity. I just thought, yeah, he's got a problem. He's got a real deep problem, and it's hard.
Dad, what does lovey mean?
Lovey is kind of. When he said I'm not a lovey?
Yeah, when he said I was never going to be a lovey.
Yeah, it's like the idea that you come down and you're all about sort of what he would define as maybe airy-fairy, arty-farty in a very kind of, you know, elitist sort of way. I loved the fact that he said that his sort of big heroes as actors and writers were all these kind of working-class guys.
So is lovey a sort of posh thing?
Yeah, it's more than that. It's kind of
taking themselves too seriously.
A little bit, yeah, yeah. Now, to be fair, you know, he does get involved in politics, but I think that's because he's still that kid who came from Dundee. I think. Do you know what I really loved was the fact that he said Logan Roy is so not Murdoch because Murdoch
came from money.
Yeah, and Logan Roy is self-made.
But it's funny that he said that was the most defining difference, because actually you don't think about that much when you're watching it. You don't think that, because I don't know Murdoch's sort of past, so I didn't ever think that, like, Murdoch didn't come from money.
Okay.
I would have easily taken it as that from watching Succession.
It was quite interesting. He obviously doesn't want people to think this is a sort of biopic type thing.
And that is a big difference.
Yeah.
Especially in terms of his relationship with his kids. I thought that was so interesting. That's the reason why he's mean to them, is because he's disappointed in them.
I know.
And that might be because they never started where he started.
Yeah.
You have a touch of that with
us.
A little bit,
yeah.
You think we're too spoiled and lucky.
Yeah, whereas I grew up in a hole in the road. And
you grew up in a cardboard box.
Well, it wasn't even cardboard.
You and your brothers shared one pair of boxes, didn't you? You all squeezed into
the
same
pair. Call them boxes in those days. It was.
What did you call them? A sheet?
It was like, they were like sort of paper.
Plastic bags.
Now, I'll tell you the other thing I really liked was that I liked how he explained the thing about independence, and he was like, you know, he's not a nationalist, he's an internationalist. He's very political. And of course, the other thing, swearing. He's good at swearing.
Fuck off.
Fuck off. Yeah, but you know what I loved best was the weary fuck off. Fuck off.
Funny where one choice takes you. From the edge of making a decision to doing research on the cutting edge. From being bored in your room to being heard in the boardroom. From the CAO to your first day at TU Dublin, ready for anything. One choice, infinite possibilities. Choose TU Dublin on your CAO.